Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. Now, you're in for a treat tonight because I have a rare interview with Jan Hammer. And if you're not familiar with who he was the original keyboardist in Mahavishnu Orchestra, and most famously, he played with Jeff Beck on Wired. So he starts with his background.
I grew up in a musical family, and I was first, just getting into piano, acoustic piano at that time. Listening to, my parents playing jazz in the house and rehearsing with the band and, bebop and jazz and all that. As I was growing up, I started getting piano lessons and playing some classical stuff, but I was completely, gone into jazz. Just so obvious, it came very natural to me. I was growing up and, getting better and playing jazz all the time. After I got over here, I came over here to Berklee College in 1968. I just got around, got connections, and got a gig with the great singer Sarah Vaughan. I spent a year working with Sarah Vaughan on piano. But I got connections eventually in New York with all the modern stuff that was happening, and so that's where electric piano came into the picture and so on. Initially, the ultimate was always Bill Evans. Every time I listen to him, even now, I'm just like totally in awe. As I was growing up, Herbie Hancock, of course, and Horace Silver, I was a great fan of. And also, eventually, as I got more into more modern sort of avant-garde jazz, I really liked Paul Bley. He's just a great, great influence too. I was influenced by many, many things. Like in growing up in Eastern Europe, or actually Central Europe, I was exposed to all kinds of beautiful folk music. The melodies were always much more fluid than the piano could produce. Combine that with then submersion into Indian music that around that same time, Mahavishnu Orchestra, we were very much influenced by classical Indian music. You add all that up together and then, a rock and roll guitar. And I was always looking for something that I could bend notes, and piano was not enough for me. I realized that once I got a Moog, I could do anything, but I discovered my true voice, like my unique voice that I could recognizable for me.
And yes, he did find his voice in those amazing records he did with Jeff Beck, There and Back, Wired, and Jeff Beck Live with Jan Hammer. Now he explains how he got involved with John McLaughlin and Billy Cobham to form Mahavishnu.
Basically, he realized that if I can play with Sarah Vaughan, I must be legit. Probably gave me good credentials, But the connection was the whole scene, downtown scene, on the Lower East Side in Manhattan. We were living in a loft, two or three at a time, and we had like all the instruments set up all the time, and every night there would be a big get-together. People would just, wander over. I guess call it jam. That's how your name or, your playing gets around. There were like, great people coming over, and eventually one of these get-togethers, Billy Cobham and John came over, and we played for quite a while. And I think that sort of locked it up for me. That was, that I was in. And it was just that scene was just amazingly alive and fertile. I don't know if that anything like that exists, because playing live instrumentally is sort of like gone by the wayside. It's very sad. After about half a year, we started the band in 1971. And like in the summer of 72, I was already using the Mini Moog on stage. I could stand up and there'd be three of us soloing, as opposed to before it was Jerry on violin and John on guitar, and there would be the voices. And I would, I would be basically behind a piano accompanying most of the time. With the synth, I could completely stand up and there'll be three of us on an equal footing. Yeah, that was a big game changer for me. It was a wonderful beginning, and obviously John brought in all the early music that we did with the band. He brought it in and it was just phenomenal, even though that a lot of it really changed in rehearsals. And that's not reflected, in the way music is usually credited. There's got to be a little different formula how to approach credits for people who actually create the music. Ours was like a case that should be studied, how to break up a band. And I felt that I was contributing more than was reflected, even though in the second and third year we got to contribute our music, but there was stuff that we did even from before that much more of our input than was known. The original band did three records, and then there was also a recording that we sort of abandoned in the summer of 3, we were in London in the Trident Studios, and we were working on, you know, on new material. You know, we were not getting along already. It was kind of hairy. So we ended up going back to this New York and doing the live from Central Park to finish the contractual obligation or whatever they call it. I'm very happy and very proud of the whole experience. I mean, I'm not, don't take me wrong. I'm not bitching about it. I'm just looking at it, you know, with a sober analytical eye, and I see what happened. But it was still an amazing, amazing leap forward for me. Yeah, the five of us, it really exploded. It was just amazing how it took off. We had no idea, you know, that it was going to get that big.
Yeah, today we don't understand how big Mahavishnu became in the early 70s when they came out, but they were on top Billboard charts. Now he explains how he actually went on to his solo career and how he met Jeff Beck and produced so many great albums.
For a while, I thought maybe Jerry Goodman and I could, you know, the two of us could put a group together and do stuff. And I bought a, you know, farm. That's where I'm still, you know, 45 years later, I'm still here. I moved here, built a studio, and Jerry came over and stayed for, you know, a few months, and we were, you know, playing, rehearsing, trying to, you know, audition people. But eventually it wouldn't work out. We made an album in 74 called Like Children. I just pulled it up a couple of days ago, and just, I didn't hear it in years. And it really sounds better than I remember. It's just really, it's really good. I was much more of a gung-ho, like, you know, let's go, let's rehearse, let's do this. And Jerry was always like, I don't know. And I couldn't handle, he's just an incredible talent that he is. And it was really hard to get him at that period of his life. He was just not all that gung-ho. Still love him. Love the way he plays. And he's just, you know, a phenomenal musician. The rest of the band, Tony Smith on drums and Fernando Saunders on bass. And that was it. We, you know, they all moved in here into the big house for quite a while. And we, you know, we just had the studio, you know, downstairs. So we just wake up, have coffee, and get in the studio and make a record. It was fun. Also, Jeff was here at the time, Jeff Beck, and we recorded stuff for Wired. But it turned out that Jeff was like a really big fan of mine. So because, you know, he heard me with John, with Mahavishnu, and we ran into each other, the two bands. Jeff was playing with Bogert and Carmine Appice, that, you know, that trio in 73. We were in Zurich playing like on two consecutive days in the same hall. And it was Jeff's birthday too, so it must have been June, I guess. And we had a birthday party in the hotel, and I ended up talking to Jeff for like a long, long time. And he ended up really clicking with me. You know, we really looked at music in a very similar way, coming from polar opposites, you know, from the hardcore rock that he was coming from, and I was coming from jazz. And he ended up, you know, came over, he showed up at my house like after the band fell apart, and he was playing me tapes from Blow by Blow that he was just recording. And then we said, we gotta work on the next album together, and that was Wired. It's basically the Blue Wind is just Jeff and I. I'm just playing then all the synths, the rest of the band, and we recorded it like in one day here. It was just beautiful. Jeff came here, and you know, it was done in my studio down here in the house. Jeff brought the tapes in progress that he did with George Martin in London. We did the overdubbed solos on things like, you know, like Lead Boots, and you know, wherever I play other than Blue Wind, it was the overdubs we done here. And then I mixed, I think, 4 or 5 tracks here, and Jeff liked the mix better than George Martin. You know, the record came out, and Jeff said, like, let's just take the whole band and go on the road. So that worked out great. We went and we traveled and played everywhere. Well, it helps to have Jeff's name attached to it, but it's also his musicianship is just so phenomenal. The guy never stops growing and evolving. I'm always shocked every time I, you know, meet him. These days, we usually meet like every 10 years or so. I went on a tour with him 2004 in all over UK and Scotland and then Royal Albert Hall. And he was just completely opening my ears, just how evolved he got. And then again, we played that big bash he had in the Hollywood Bowl, I guess his 50th anniversary of rocking around. So that's about as often as I play live now. It's like every 10 years. I don't have stomach for like traveling every day and rehearsing and sound checks. And it's, you know, I've done it to death.
Yeah, I completely understand. That's how so many musicians and bands get completely burnt out of the scene because they tour nonstop. Now he explains how he became a drummer, built his own studio in his farmhouse and landed Miami Vice.
Well, I was, obviously the piano was first, but it was the drums were always somehow more fun, especially early on when you have to practice, you know, sort of laborious practice scales, and you know, you have to keep at it for hours. And then all that, I would get on drums and I would say, well, this is fun. Yeah, I would just put on, you know, anything with Tony Williams or Elvin Jones and play along and just like pick up stuff from them. And you wouldn't believe it, but I came over here, and after I built a studio here the first year, the first person who recorded in the studio here was Elvin Jones with us. We made his album called On the Mountain, just with my partner Gene, the bass player, and Elvin, the three of us here. Elvin just came over and stayed for like a week. And then a couple of years later, Tony Williams came up here to record some of the tunes for his The Joy of Flying. But I did two tunes here in the studio with Tony. So I got to play with, you know, Tony and Elvin, you know, my idol drummers. So after I did, you know, Miami Vice, where I really made some, I guess, good money, I was able to move the whole studio into a barn on the same property here, which is like next door. There is a very beautiful live big room. That's what I have now, yeah. The barn was here and we just fixed it up and built an honest to goodness studio, because the studio that I have in the house was more like a super duper home studio. You know, it wasn't architecturally or anything like that. It was just, there was microphones and, you know, mixing board and a 16 track and it was all a mess, wire cables on the floor and, you know, but we still did some good stuff here. Well, it was all thanks to Michael Mann, you know, that he always, and he tries to one-up himself as far as something you never seen before or haven't heard before. So I was at the right place at the right time through a mutual friend. I met with him and he was putting together the show, and I played him some sketches that I had, you know, carried with me that I just worked on. And one of the things I played him was the actual theme that, you know, that became the theme of the show. I wasn't commissioned to write a theme. You know, I already had the team. I stayed with the show for 4 years. So, and then I had to bail. It was just an incredible stressful situation. It was like a show, one show a week. And, you know, this footage would come here and I would score it, send it back. And next week started right away. And it was, you know, just barely making it to air. But what helped was that he gave me a room to run. He basically said, you know, once we get picked up for the 22 series run, so he told me to run with it. Just, you know, do whatever I want, put it and even place it where I want. So we didn't go through any kind of a spotting session where, you know, you would sit with the director and say, I want music here or there. I would just put music there and they would use it. I sent it to the sound editor with detailed notes. I was the only one in the history of movie making to work that way.
He's absolutely right, because I don't know of any other composer that would be given that many liberties to do whatever he wants on a television show. Now he explains how he got his signature synth sound and all the gear that he's used.
Well, I would have to admit in all humility that I didn't come up with it as such, because people have used it, you know, people like Giorgio Moroder, and it's basically using a sequencer. A sequencer is a box that plays the instrument according to your commands, but it can do it, make it almost, you know, totally precisely in time or not if you don't want it. But if you know, to get a pulsating beds for music, it's like there's nothing like it. Sequencers are it. Now the sequencer, you know, then it's like included on in built in into all the synthesizers these days. But what I did was originally for the Miami Vice, I was using Fairlight, and I would like sampled my own drums into it and congas, and then just program the rhythms on the screen. What I did was I sampled my favorite Moog hits and sounds into it, and then I rearranged them in the Fairlight. Yeah, like we played Star Cycle at the Hollywood Bowl. I use a Korg Triton Extreme synthesizer, which has a sequencer built in. You know, I programmed the whole pattern of the Star Cycle sequencer into it, and then that goes straight into the headphones for the drummer and on the monitors on stage. Good musicians can lock in with that. I was always using like bleeding edge instruments, you know, usually prototypes, and they were all like, you know, glued together. There were some concerts that, you know, things sort of fell apart and I had to, you know, run and get use some older equipment. But believe me, you do have a little bit of anxiety. Like, it's totally different from stage fright, because I don't have any stage fright, because I know I can handle it. Is the instrument going to handle it? You know, that's Moog comes back and every time. And Oberheim, obviously, the really good sounds on Wired. The solo sound is Oberheim expander module. You could just get screeching, screaming, you know, sort of semi-wah-wah, but, you know, with harmonics. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful piece of gear. And eventually, I got more into samplers. So it was, you know, either Fairlight sampling individual before there was, you know, before it was normal, but I would sample individual guitar notes and then have them mapped out over the keyboard and then play through amp. So it's sort of like a ghost guitar. It sounds like a guitar, but you know it's not, because it's played over a keyboard. Yeah, that was basically evolution of the Oberheim expander module. I actually had a system with six of those in a frame, and it was connected to a portable lightweight fiberglass keyboard. Again, it was such a liberating thing, you know, because all my life I was playing sitting down, and then all of a sudden you can like be out there and play at people. Eventually, I also started using a lot of the latest Korg synths, and I've been using them a lot, you know, for most of the time. The way it goes now, as far as gear, a lot of it is virtual in the box, in the computer. You have the panel on screen, and the sound is identical, but I don't have to deal with hardware breaking down or anything. It's just a, you know, it's in the box. It's virtual instrument. And that's basically where I've been operating lately.
I know everybody is in the box today. That is the key phrase. But I do miss those days in the studio. Now he explains how he met Hendrix and his Neil Schon records, as well as all of his projects he's currently working on.
I came very, very close with Jimmy. We were in recording in his studio with Jeremy Steig, the, you know, flute player. This was before Mahavishnu, even. And we were at Electric Lady on 8th Street in the Village. And Jimmy just sauntered in and, you know, was listening to us. And we got to talking. But he was, like, very keen on it. He really liked what we were doing. And then he said we should, you know, get together. God damn it, he'd have to go to England and die. Jesus, that was shocking. But, I mean, I came close. I mean, I hung out with him and we talked. And no, he was just such a mellow spirit, just wonderful guy. Plus, you know, ferocious, ferocious player. I mean, just talk about influence. Everything I do, there's always something that, what would Jimmy do now? Of course, other than Miles Davis, which is probably the principal influence on how to put one note next to each other. I remember the guys from Santana, very much into, like, Carlos and John were both following the same guru, but they were like crazy about Mahavishnu Orchestra. And I remember we played at the Winterland in San Francisco, and the whole Santana band was like backstage, you know, going crazy. And then when I went on the road with Jeff, we would play double bill with Journey, you know, and Neil Schon is one of those people who is like so hyper, he cannot stop. So even like we would have sound check, and we would finish our sound check. They were all set up, and Neil would be hanging around. And so I would just get in behind Billy Cobham's drum set, and we would just jam with Neil to no end. This was the early roots, how we got into that we eventually made two albums together like that. Yes, yes, that was done also in the ground floor studio in my house right here. It really sounded like the way I imagined it should, and it still does. I'm very, very proud of the two records. Yeah, the layering on the guitar, Neil had at the time that early Roland guitar synthesizer, where he would play the big rhythm parts that he does so, you know, so well, because everybody thinks he's a lead killer. He is an amazing rhythm guitar player. And he would play these things, and he would layer his guitar from an amp in the center, and then we would have the guitar synth on one side, and then guitar synth amped on another side. So there was like a wall of Neil Schon. That's really how we got the huge, huge wall of sound happening. The synth was tracking whatever you did on the guitar. It was just an amazing, beautiful sound. The latest thing that a proper Honest to Goodness album was released in 2 years ago, called Seasons Part 1. If you didn't see it or hear it, please check it out, because you'll definitely love it. I'm not playing physical drums anymore, but programming and, you know, shaping and triggering it from keys. So it's still my sense of feel, but I don't play acoustic drums. And then I also had lots of little sketches and snippets of jazzy kind of music. So I put out a sort of like an EP with all the little snippets. It's called Sketches in Jazz. I'm currently working on Seasons Part 2.
It was such a great pleasure to speak with Jan Hammer, because when I was growing up in New York in the 70s, I used to listen to those Jeff Beck records all the time and wonder, who is this cat, Jan Hammer? He's an amazing keyboardist. Now here's Mahu Vishnu Orchestra with Sister Andrea.
Thank you.
This is Jan Hammer, and you're listening to Guitar Tracks on WFIT-FM, the best instrumental music on Florida's Space Coast.
I love that track, The Ride, by Neil Schon and Jan Hammer. Before that was one of my favorite tracks, Star Cycle, featuring Jeff Beck and Jan Hammer.